Okay, so we are all ready. I will discuss now the theoretical approach that we've started. We started quite a while ago, in the mid-90s probably, about the possible explanation of glass formation in terms of frustration. Actually, maybe Bulbul was here, but in the jamming meeting in 97, that was held here in this room, I gave a couple of talks on the frustration-based approach. It was just at the beginning, so I hope we've made some progress. Some of the great hopes we have, of course, failed, but it's life. Anyhow, this is this work we started with our late friend Daniel Kivelson, Steve Kivelson, Zohar. And the more recent part here that we'll present was done with my former student, François Sosa, in Paris, and my colleague, Pascal Vieux. So before I go into the more deeply into the subject, let me try to give some perspective on this and what we are trying to achieve compared to other people in the field. And in this workshop, as always, it's always something that strikes me is the diversity of views on glasses and glass formation and glass transition. It seems like we do not even agree on what makes the problem interesting. It was true also in 1997. Hey, and it was true probably in 1904. I'm not saying it's a brand new.
No, I'm saying that we haven't made progress.
We haven't made progress on it. And on the theory part, especially of the glass transition, which is a more restricted topic, even what would it take to declare it solved? People claim it's already solved, so why are we working on it? In terms of different approaches, we've heard a lot, especially people doing simulations. They are interested by an approach in terms of, I would say, atomic level description and kind of local relaxation mechanisms, trying to see what's happening in the system. On the other hand, this is not the approach I will take, and some of us are interested in some kind of grand scheme. You coarse grain, you scale, and then you have underlying universality and critical points and stuff like this for the glass transition. And, of course the two are not necessarily, antagonists, and that one might be completely foolish. So I'm making statements here that are personal statements. I'm not claiming it's the truth. So you don't have to agree with all of this. In terms of critical points now, again, to give you a little orientation at what we're trying to do, there are many theories, and critical point can be, in those theories, dynamic or static, unattainable, unreachable, because it's at a lower temperature than the glass transition temperature, or avoided. So, for instance, the mode coupling theory would be a dynamic transition which is avoided. The random first order transition theory will be a static transition which is unreachable. And you can classify the theories basically with that. So the theory we'll be discussing has a static critical point which is avoided. Okay, so it's what is original about this.
I'm
going to
ask a question, I hope you don't mind. So
No.
You've
please.
Done a really nice job of outlining what we don't know and where the confusions are. Can you tell me, what do we agree on as when we say the glass transition? What do we mean?
The glass transition, I think we all agree on the fact that, so this is the usual Arrhenius plot, log over 1 over t. We all agree on the fact that at one point, you run out of time and your system kinetically becomes out of equilibrium and out of equilibrium system. And this is a kinetic transition. That's the glass transition defined in the lab or in the computer on a much, much shorter time scale. So that we agree, everybody agrees that this is not a true phase transition, either dynamic or not. It is, in fact, the crossover from equilibrium state to out of equilibrium state. I think everybody agrees on that. So we are trying to describe, in fact, what leads to this kinetic phenomenon. And of course, again, because it seems, at least for fragile systems, it seems like pretty dramatic change of dynamics. It is, you know, understandable that you would like to put a divergence someplace down here, and that's a Vogel-Fulcher, for instance, fit. My take on this, which again is biased, so take this as a biased view, is that what always struck me is I worked on the normal liquid first in decades ago. And all right, you work on the liquid, you know, which has some dynamics and it slows down as you cool it. Now, if you extrapolate the normal liquid behavior, melting is around here, the normal liquid behavior, you could extrapolate it. And of course, you reach a point at which eventually you will fall out of equilibrium, right? But it's not what is observed, because you fall out of equilibrium much, much faster than you would have anticipated. To me, and again, many people disagree, it's the sign that there is something truly collective, cooperative, going on in the supercooled liquid that is different from what is going on in the normal liquid. And then, if there is indeed something which is collective and which shows up in the more fragile systems, glass formers, then we might look indeed for something which is detail independent, collective, and might have critical points in there. Now, when we say critical points for us theorists, we are no dumb. That is, we know you do not observe any critical point in the phenomenology, right? So there's no singularity, no divergence that anybody observes, and that's a fact. So the critical point, again, that's why it has to be either unreachable, but still controlling what's going on, or avoided and still controlling what's going on. So that's basically the framework in which we are trying to make progress and do something.
So if I could just ask. Yes. So you're describing the grass transition then as falling out of equilibrium into some metastable state. That, as you show here, it could be a rather gradual transition in terms of temperature. You say there's no observed singularity, but in terms of like when you do thermal scan, I mean, you could measure a glass transition temperature. Yeah. That's not a singular event, but it is
narrow.
Yeah, narrower.
Yeah,
I mean.
Yeah. Okay.
You're thinking about something more broadly, though. Is that right?
No. I'm thinking about this. To me, this state is, you can use equilibrium statistical mechanics. It's not quite true, because of course we know that this state is metastable with respect to the crystal, but you know, with some thought we can at least make any measurements here that will be independent of time. There's no aging, everything is reproducible. So all this is equilibrium, and you don't have to go fast. I mean, you can go to one temperature and really let the system equilibrate, so that's fine. And in fact, that's the equilibrium part that is of interest. The fact that you fall out of equilibrium, which is, you know, again, the kinetic phenomenon, occurs on a narrow, very narrow range, is something that is described by, you know, empirical, phenomenological approaches. And I think it's fine this way, you know, because it's probably much too hard, the falling out of equilibrium, much too hard to describe in a truly theoretical way. What might try, okay, but that's not what I am after. So indeed, that phenomenon here, in which probably you would see, you know, crossover to a different slope here, is not what I consider as important for what I'm saying here.
Okay, good. Thanks.
Is it fair to say that, I mean, your main question is why the growth is much faster than Arrhenius?
That's the way I would put it. Why is the growth much faster than Arrhenius? Again, this is the way I put it. People will try to have their take of the glass transition with a slightly different picture. All right, now go to frustration. And yeah, please.
Just one short question also related, just to get an idea of scale, what you have in mind. I mean, if you look at that liquid, say if you look at the equation of state of the liquid up to close that singularity, if you take, let's say, a 10th order virial expansion includes the order of 10 particles, you can get that behavior pretty clearly. So what you're suggesting is that beyond a certain point, there'll be a move to an increasing amount of diagrams necessary to be able to represent that part of the...
No,
Or no?
No. Is that enough, or? No, I think let's go back to the same. It's good because it's the same good old picture, but we, no, that's not what I want. Okay, first there are the thermodynamics of the system and the pair structure factor, okay? Those things are, you know, pretty uninteresting and boring as you look at their temperature dependence. For those properties, you could probably re-sum diagrams and, you know, get the full thing up to that point. Now, what is striking here is that despite the fact that the basic thermodynamics, well, we might think about configurational entropy as aside, but the basic thermodynamics and the pair correlation function, the basic pair correlation function, is indeed pretty trivial as far as its temperature dependence changes. Nothing happens, truly. The dynamics is very dramatic because it changes by 14 orders of magnitude. And that's the dynamics, which is hard to describe in terms of diagrams. And of course, if we think in terms of collective process, you would need subtle collective process that gives rise to a strong slowdown of the dynamics without affecting much, for instance, the pair correlation function or the pressure of the system. Okay, so that's of course what is tricky about the problem of the glass transition. Otherwise, it would have been solved. If everything, thermodynamics, pressure, pair correlation functions, and dynamics, were going together and pseudo-diverging, then I guess it will no longer be a problem, I think.
You're saying that dynamics is sensitive to quantum...
It's good, because I have only two slides, so keep going.
You're saying that dynamics is sensitive to small changes in pair correlation function, or did the answer
is
somewhere else?
Okay, here you're giving... It's my feeling that I'm going to give you, okay? And a little work that we did on the side, which is not related to here, to what I will present here. What I think is that... First, there is a very general proof on which if you have a diverging relaxation time, you must have diverging static correlation length. Now, the question is that correlation length can be extremely subtle and hard to measure. In the proof, actually, that what Bulbul mentioned yesterday, the proof goes, for instance, with something which is a 0.2 set correlation that is not the correlation between two points, that would be the pair structure, not correlation between one point and several others, which is, I think, might be useful in what I will do later on, but a correlation between one point and a whole set of points, say a boundary. Now, that in the structure. So you need structural information and the diverging of the relaxation time, or kind of diverging of relaxation time is related to that structure. On the other hand, I don't think that the small changes that you see in the pair correlation function will explain especially the super Arrhenius part here. And in a recent work that we did with Ludovic Berthier on how mode coupling theory can explain two different models that have almost the same pair structure with subtle differences but very different dynamics, show that, you know, it doesn't seem to be possible just to explain the strong slowdown by subtle changes in the pair correlation function, the static pair correlation function. But again, people would disagree. I can't say that there's a definite proof of this.
So just to keep you on this slide again.
Yeah.
So would you agree with the statement that every system forms a glass? So
The
reason why I say that is because if you quench fast enough, then you're sampling everything uniformly, and the system can get stuck in an amorphous state. And so, what's the interplay between the amount of temperature range which you try equilibrium versus?
All right. Okay. I think that to form a glass, the first thing that you need is a voided crystal, and we discussed this, Patrick's talk. to avoid a crystal, as I said, and was discussed, you need some sort of first order transition to the crystal. So that the meaning of supercooling is that you have a disordered state below the crystal transition. Again, if, and I, you know, we've tried and people have tried, if the crystallization transition is continuous, as in two dimensions, and I will show some of the stuff we tried to do, is continuous.
Is it still debatable that it's a very, very, very weakly first order?
Well, there are systems, yes, it is debatable. So there are systems for which it is very weakly first order, and then in principle, but nobody has been able to, you could quench super, super fast, even in a computer, and try to supercool and see if you hit the glass. In principle, it would be possible. If it is truly continuous, then I think that no matter how fast you will do it, you will not get a glass. So I think it's in most systems, I agree, you would get a glass if you quenched.
It seems like a special, special case where you don't get a glass. It's very special.
It's a case where there is no frustration, yes. Well, that's the point. Yes, indeed, that's why glasses are ubiquitous. I agree.
I mean, the kind of thing, questions that you're asking for that to be relevant, one should be able to sort of locally equilibrate in the supercooled regime so that one can measure viscosities and
so. Yes, precisely. So that's for defining a state which is not directly glassy, you would need some range where which you can local equilibrate your system so that indeed, as I said, your measurements would be time independent. And it's possible that in those cases where the transition is weak first order and you quench at a rate which is so high that you know you indeed fall out of equilibrium, but on the way you're never at equilibrium, so you cannot define a supercooled liquid.
So just those rates are important for other systems, and that's why I'm bringing it up. Like if you think about a granular material, possibly those really high rates are relevant.
No, I mean, high rates are important, I guess, for metallic glasses. So it's not, I mean, it's true.
Think you can do this kind of equilibrium analysis in those systems, right? There is no range over the...
Yeah, there is a range. It's that lipid range.
Oh, you mean here?
The same thing you could say for a strong glass, which you're not going to talk about, right? So just
Arrhenius.
We can talk about
boring. Arrhenius, boring. My view, okay. Should I keep going? All right, so frustration in liquids. I'm sorry, Patrick, to show the icosahedron, but you know there is polytetrahedral here. So frustration, as that was discussed by Patrick Charbonneau the other day. So it's in that context, okay, of glasses and liquids and generally soft condensed matter. It's the idea that there's an incompatibility between the local structure, the best local structure that you can have in a system, for instance, by minimizing some local free energy, and global order. So the fact that you cannot, in fact, extend that local structure to large distances, so that there is a frustration between long-range order, like crystalline order could be, and the local order in the liquid. And again, the paradigm that was also discussed is that polytetrahedral order, where the best local order, again, in 3D for spheres is a tetrahedron. Not a bad idea is to put 20 tetrahedra together in an icosahedron, but of course, because of all sorts of reasons, you know, voids here or symmetry here, the fivefold symmetry, there's no way you're going to have a global tiling in a crystal made of icosahedral local structures, and instead you get an FCC on an HCP crystal. Now, frustration has been invoked in the past for explaining supercooling. So that was, as Patrick said, that was Frank's idea. And it has, you know, it was in 52, and it has been shown only in 2009. So it's 57 years, so it takes a long time. So I hope to be here in 57 years and see how these ideas go for the glass transition. Now for glasses, especially for metallic glasses, this idea of the icosahedral order and frustrated icosahedral order have been used in the early 80s of what is in all things about curved space approach. And I will just say a word about this by David Nelson, his co-workers, and a French school with Sadok Mosri and Jim Setna too. Now the curved space approach was to realize, in fact, that indeed there is frustration in our Euclidean regular world, but if you can have a little bit of imagination, right, and consider that you could curve our three-dimensional world to put it, for instance, on the surface of a hypersphere, so it's a four-dimensional hypersphere, and you curve the world to put it on the surface, for a given radius of curvature of that hypersphere, indeed, the voids here, for instance, will just be filled, and you will have a crystal formed by icosahedral structures or tetrahedral structures. So by curving space, generally speaking, you can remove the frustration that you have in Euclidean space.
So if you curved it and then filled in the voids and then unwrapped it, would the particles then overlap then? Is that what would happen? Is that what you mean by removing?
If you curve it, then those particles here, those two particles here will come closer, if you in positive curvature, okay, will come closer until you fill the gaps.
So then, if you unwrapped it again, they'd overlap.
If you unwrapped it, you will open the gaps. You will open the gaps again.
Negative
curvature, then you will widen the gap, and then it's even worse. I mean, the tetrahedral order is even less interesting when you go to negative curvature.
The reason I ask is because in polymer glasses, the important thing is that the beads, they do overlap, and so that introduces competing length scales. So if you could somehow do it, some curvature where if, then in 4D, where if you unwrapped it,
yes,
it introduces an overlap, then that would be
well, yes. No, I guess it in principle, it, well, not in principle, it might be possible. I mean, this idea of tinkering with the matrix of space, so that you can satisfy all the constraints or all the interactions you want, is a pretty reasonable idea. I don't know if people. I mean, that's one of the points I wanted to mention now. Is I don't think people have done it for polymers. That's for sure.
Well, and just to get the overlap is the important thing.
Yeah, well, it should be possible.
Okay.
Now the one of the main drawbacks of the frustration approach, we have to be honest at some point, is that so what we did in this is build upon all those early work to have a theory of the glass transition, and the theory of the glass transition needs a giant leap, which is we assume basically that frustration is ubiquitous, and that in every liquid, take, orthotriphenyl or whatever, dibutyl, phthalate, whatever, anything like this, that there will be a local structure that minimizes some local free energy, and that structure does not tile space, and this is why you have a first order transition for the crystal, and that the whole idea of having frustration, this incompatibility, will be valid for any kind of liquid forming, glass forming liquid. We're working on this, on model of molecular liquids to see if this has some merit, if we can really pin down what is the local structure, how does it work, and so on. It's been ongoing work for a number of years, and it's hard to do. So we have no answer on this, okay? So this is a postulate that frustration is ubiquitous in liquids and can explain then some of the features of glass formation, and that by playing with space or changing some of the parameters, you can suppress the frustration and get to an ideal world, you know, where there's no frustration. That's the. I don't know if I'd like to live.
The frustration is essential to the whole glass.
The frustration, as I said, is fundamental. Why would I?
Because why are we interested in looking for cases to eliminate the frustration?
Well, maybe it might even be in my next slide.
And actually, if you can back up for just a second.
Oh, yes, yes, of course, of course.
I mean, if you're interested in modifying the frustration illustrated, for example, by this icosahedron, there's a similar approach. You don't need recourse to the fourth dimension, but if you just change the relative size of the spheres and put a smaller sphere in the center, then you do the same thing, that you you begin to reduce and eliminate that frustration.
You can do that.
But it's just too easy, I think, maybe, because you're only seeing it three dimensions.
No, it's not clear.
This basic thing between local and global, right?
Yeah, it's not clear. It has to be checked. I mean, that's, again, part of the work which is done now, because for many years, even in simulations, people really do not look at those local structures and how they are frustrated or what. So it has to be checked, you know. What is the local, and I'll show a few results on it.
Yeah.
How is the local structure of some of these binary mixtures, for instance? Do you really suppress completely frustration?
You reduce local frustration, but you retain global frustration, because you still have the fivefold symmetry that has inherent in it.
It has the fivefold symmetry, but you want to make sure that the fivefold symmetry is relevant to your problem.
Yes.
Okay, so anyhow, I think it's open. I mean,
an answer to that, or at least an experimental answer, is found in all these quasi-crystalline phases that go over the complex alloy phases that have huge unit cells. I guess that would.
Yeah.
Exactly. So that would probably answer a little bit of that. If you choose two sizes or three sizes, you can actually go from a glass to a quasicrystal to a complex crystalline phase.
You can, but not necessarily. There are very, very special conditions where you
sure,
get that.
Sure.
And so there are special conditions where you can also begin to attack the global packing frustration. It's very simple to reduce the local packing frustration by that's much more general.
But I'm wondering, how do you go towards a crystalline long range?
Well,
because in fact there are reports of
the last time I gave 2-3 hours seminars, so you know I'm happy to. Let me go back to this point, because frustration obviously helps you to avoid one type of crystal. Okay, so here, for instance, if you have frustration, that means you will not have long-range icosahedral order. But again, you can still find, you know, nature, in fact, is pretty damn like the ordering state. And in fact, even with frustration, you could have, but at lower temperature usually, different kind of ordered phase where it's, and I'll show this later, it's the defects within the ideal order that will themselves order. So of course this is a much larger unit cell, and in fact the Frank-Casper phases can be thought of in this kind of way as crystalline arrays basically of disclination lines within the icosahedral background. Okay, so there's always, you will hit, even if you basically are happy because you've missed the first crystal, then at some point you might hit another one, and you know it's a never-ending story. All right, so why am I interested to vary frustration and even suppress frustration? Is that, let me draw a little diagram here, is that if I have, let's say this is the temperature axis, and this is some frustration axis, and this is zero here. So in zero frustration, let's say I can have a weak transition to a long-range order phase. And because there's no frustration, again, that's because the local order in that case,
yes,
will tile space as well.
Let me interrupt there. I don't think that's correct. If you look at a crystal, I don't think it's correct to say there's no frustration. When you look at the crystal, you trade off local packing frustration for global packing frustration. Locally, the packing is less efficient in a crystal than an ICOS heater, but the global aspect wins out.
I'm with you, but this is here. This is in the real liquid. When you curve space, then the local packing is the same as the global packing. And I'll use the two-dimensional example, so that was used also by Patrick. So the local packing is triangular or hexagonal, and it will fit and tile the whole space with the triangular lattice. But this is not true in three-dimensional, and as far as we know, there's no examples in three dimensions where you can have that kind of non-frustrated systems. Again, that's why glasses are ubiquitous in three dimensions. But now if you allow yourself to go to a reference system by curving space in the case of icosahedral or by other means where there is no frustration, then you will have an ordering transition, which again, because there's no frustration, will be either weakly first order or continuous. And the real liquid, of course, is at a given frustration, and which is fixed. It's fixed by the nature of the interactions and the nature of the Euclidean space. And the reason why we would be interested, and we are interested, by a zero frustration limit is that if this is a critical or weakly first order transition, then of course it will have some effect in the whole diagram. And as we like to say, that critical point will control the behavior of all systems which come close enough to that point. So if my real liquid comes in and is at a weak enough frustration, then it will feel the effect of the critical point here, and then its behavior will change. And this is precisely the starting point of the frustration-based approach that we had, is that, in fact, what you see here as the deviation from super-Arrhenius behavior could be assigned to an avoided critical point. So this one is avoided because as soon as you put frustration, there's no ordering possible, and an avoided critical point that controls the behavior. And then you can understand why basically the proximity of a critical point gives you collective behavior, as usual. You know, you have a correlation length that grows. But the fact that you have frustration in your system, that is, your system is frustrated, it tells you that the correlation cannot grow forever. It has to feel the frustration and stop growing. So that in fact, what your system will end up with, your liquid, it will be just a mosaic of frustration-limited domains whose size, you know, change with temperature. And doing this, we did also some scaling analysis of this. So again, you see this is avoided, and this is at high temperature. So basically, we scale the liquid contrary to what most theorists will do, is use a scaling temperature, which is a low temperature scaling temperature. We like to scale with a high temperature here and scale below here what we perceive as the collective behavior due to the proximity of this avoided singularity. Okay, and there are in different sorts of models for frustration. There's some pretty rigorous proof, and Zohar was involved in those, that indeed the avoided singularity is a very generic behavior.
Require this T-star transition to be a continuous transition?
Well, it has to be either continuous or weakly first order, because otherwise, if it's strongly first ordered, I mean, you might have remains of this, but at least you will not be able to use scaling behavior. And the scaling, of course, as everybody else in the field, we scaled, we used a few empirical parameters, of course, because we know only scaling exponents, and you fit right, left, and center all the phenomenology possible in liquid. So you fit the relaxation time, you fit the relaxation functions, you fit the the divergence, well, the separation of between rotational and translational time. So you do this a lot, you know, and of course it works because, you know, otherwise, you know, we wouldn't have keep up with. But it works like all other theories. Let me just finish this, okay? All other theories on the market, of course, fit the data. So that's not enough. So that was my first message here before you have the question, is that we do fit the data, but it's not enough because we have adjustable parameters. And so we need something more.
So when you say scaling, is it scaling of space?
A scaling theory around a critical point.
When you're saying the scaling holds, is it a scaling of only space or both space and time?
Do you have dynamical scaling and static scaling? Is that what you're asking?
Oh, okay. Well, here it turns out that the dynamical scaling is indeed interesting because it is activated dynamical scaling. So we have a scaling for the activation barrier, for the activation free energy. And we use this to fit the data on all possible glass forming liquids. And it fits, but again, you know, I'm not sure I'm glad it fits, because otherwise probably we would have to change the exponents. But it's not, again, it is not enough. So this is for all theories, it's not only this one, is when you see a theory that fits the data, you know that another one, which is totally different, would fit the data just as well. Well, you might battle for the chi-square, you know, and stuff like this, but I don't think it is interesting. Now, something which goes with this, which is I think easy to understand, is that fragility, which is how much you deviate from the Arrhenius behavior, and which in some sense is the degree of collective behavior in the system. That is, if you are not collective and molecular, you're here, and the more collective you are, the more super Arrhenius you will be. And fragility goes in that approach inversely with frustration. And again, this is easy to understand because if you are at small frustration, you will feel more the effect of the critical point, so your ordering will be on larger distances. And then, of course, the collective behavior then will extend over larger distances and will be stronger. And the higher the frustration, then the shorter will be the length on which you feel this collective effect, and then the fragility will decrease. So that's you know, not totally trivial.
Jim, can I ask a quick question?
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't want to.
You mentioned Jim Sepner's work. Jim had sort of this qualitative phase diagram at one point, but there's also a critical point along the frustration axis at zero temperature.
Yeah.
This was this activated scaling thing.
Yeah.
In your models,
No. That was a very specific, this is a quite technical problem, but having activated critical scaling at a critical point is very hard. Okay, it's not something that you get like this. There are very few models on which you get this, and the one known model, which is the random fieldizing model, and so Jim Sepner was trying to map the glasses on that.
But
model.
I was just wondering if you could in your models.
No, we don't. That's not the plan. Okay, let me give you a little bit of results that are not from our group, so kind of trust them a little more. And that's by Koslovich and Pastore about locally preferred structures, again, in mixtures in that case, three-dimensional binary liquid mixtures, and how you can relate maybe this to fragility of the relaxation time. So they looked at the number of mixtures. So here is the Cobb-Anderson, we heard about this, the 80-20 mixture, non-additive. And this is the Wanstrom model, which is an additive mixture, if I remember. So these are two binary Lennard-Jones mixture. And what they found in their analysis of the structure, of the Voronoi structure, of the inherent structures of the system, so I guess you've heard this in previous talks, is that this one indeed, the Wahnström, has the icosahedron as the most likely local structure based with the tetrahedra, and this one does not. So the local structure of this one, and I think it's interesting because it means that the icosahedron is not, you know, the only thing local structure one should think of. It's clear that other liquids may have kind of different types of local structure. So this one is a twisted bicapped square prism, and it has a different way of adapting tetrahedra, actually. It's not polytetrahedral. And what they show is that, you know, at low temperature, you have, you know, some clusters of these guys defined with some measure as usual. And here it's more isotropic, and here it's more anisotropic behavior. What is interesting is that, still the same work, is that then they compared the fraction of atoms in that local structure as a function of temperature, and that's the Wahnström, so the one which is icosahedral, and that one has a fraction that grows more rapidly than the binary Lennard-Jones, okay, which is for this twisted bicap, is a more steady and modest increase. And when they look at the Arrhenius plot of the relaxation time, they found that indeed the fragility of this one, that should be, you know, to see this in perspective, we should rescale like here, but it doesn't matter. The slope here, of course, is larger in this one than this one, meaning that the fragility of the Wahnström model is stronger, higher than the fragility of this one. So indeed, it tells us that it's not unreasonable to correlate the fragility with the fact that the system has a high degree of development of extension of the local order. Okay, so that's for the... now I'm going to the more recent work where we are trying to, again, see if there is something rigorous in what we are saying. And the thing that we want to check here is this idea that having an avoided critical point will indeed drive the dynamics in the way we say that is, that the more frustrated, the less fragile, that you will form a glass doing this. And to do that, we cheat in a way. That is, we want a system which is as well defined as possible. So we want a system in which we know what is the local order. Okay? And as I said, in a real liquid, we don't really know what it is. So here, I want to know what is the local order. And second, I want to know that there is frustration, and I would like to be able to tune the frustration continuously to see that theoretical picture. Because otherwise, a given liquid, again, has a given frustration. And if I want to go to another frustration, I have to choose another liquid. So everything changes, even the chemical, the local chemical information. So here what we did is look at an atomic model, and the atomic model is a Lennard-Jones liquid, a one-component Lennard-Jones liquid in two dimensions. Now, we know that the local order of this guy is the hexagonal, as I said, the hexagonal order. And to frustrate the stuff, so maybe you can go to the next slide. So to frustrate the stuff, we have to go to curved space. That is, in Euclidean, so it's the opposite of three-dimensional space. In three-dimensional space, you remember, Euclidean space has frustrated tetrahedral or frustrated icosahedral order. Here in Euclidean space, 2D, you have unfrustrated hexagonal or triangular order. And then, of course, in that case, we'll see that you have no glass. You can form no glass. Now, if you curve space, on the other hand, this time, you will frustrate the hexagonal order, and you might think then that it's indeed a case in which you will form a glass. And since curvature is something that you can tune continuously, then we will have a handle to check if at least some of what we are saying is worthwhile behind, you know, beyond the hand waving that we always do. And this idea actually was Nelson's. He had this idea that you see in the icosahedron order, you have those little voids that need to open between the spheres around a central one. And in fact, when you curve space with negative curvature, you have the same. That is, you have little voids that open between the spheres around a central one. So in fact, this idea is that frustrated hexagonal order in negatively curved two-dimensional space is, you know, similar to frustrated icosahedral order in three-dimensional Euclidean space. So that's the idea. Now, the reason why we take negative is, well, all right, because it looks more like the icosahedron. But the real reason was that, of course, if you take positive curvature, then you end up on a sphere, and the sphere is a finite system. And if you want to change the curvature of the frustration, then you change the size of your sphere. So you cannot study finite size effects, for instance, at constant curvature on a sphere. But the hyperbolic plane has the nice feature of being an infinite plane, and you can do whatever you want in that system, study finite size effects at constant curvature. So let me give you a little bit of idea on hyperbolic geometry. So the hyperbolic plane is a plane of constant negative curvature. So it's like a negative curvature, remember, is it's like a saddle point. So a saddle point, you have a positive eigenvalue for the curvature and a negative eigenvalue for the curvature, so that the Gaussian curvature, which is the product of those, is negative. Now, of course, a saddle point, as you realize, you cannot have a saddle point everywhere in three-dimensional space. So it turns out that a surface of constant negative Gaussian curvature cannot be embedded in three-dimensional space. So that's the bummer. It's likely four-dimensional space that you cannot envisage otherwise than by projections. Here it's the same. It's two-dimensional, but you have to use projections. And so that's the metric, which is basically, you know, similar to the sphere, except that you replace the radius of the sphere by an imaginary radius. And
sorry about that. Curvature should not be too strong. Then seven becomes again rational.
Operation. I'll show you that. Yes. Precisely. Yes. And I'm showing this because I will show you configurations of particles. So. A nice projection, which was used by artists before, is the Poincaré disk model, which is a conformal projection. So the whole hyperbolic plane is projected onto a disk. Okay, so this line here is so it's infinity. Okay, so here you are infinity. Here that's the center, and here it's infinity. So of course the distances are strongly distorted in that representation. So a disk like here, you know, will be this side when it's moving this way, and will shrink to a point when it reaches infinity. But the angles are the same. So it's a conformal representation where the angles between particles are the same as in the hyperbolic plane. What else do you know? Well, these are just the geodesic, but I don't think you need all that information. A little more on the simulation, so it's a simple one-component Lennard-Jones liquid, you know, our favorite. It's MD simulation, so it has lots of tricks, but it doesn't matter here. And we use periodic boundary conditions in different types of periodic boundary conditions, so that here what you see is the elementary cell of the system. So here, in that case, it's an octagon. And that's the tiling of the whole space that you see here. So you have the primitive cell with the system in it, but of course the system will be replicated everywhere here. And by changing the periodic boundary condition, you can change the size of the system and look at finite size effects. That's all what is needed. Now, to go to Takeshi's question, so we work at fixed frustration, which is basically some kind of inverse of radius of curvature times the diameter of a particle. So it's a sigma over the radius of curvature, that kappa sigma. We will work at fixed density, which is 0.85, something like this, change the temperature, and again, the systems area can be changed by changing the periodic boundary condition. So that's the same plot as here, okay? So frustration now is kappa, the inverse of radius of curvature, times sigma. Kappa equals zero is the Euclidean plane. And this is temperature. So in zero temperature, what you expect is that you have a weakly first order or two very close continuous transition, and then a hexagonal crystal. Okay, so that's our T star here. Now, when you curve the system up to this value, which is fairly high in some sense, it means that the radius of curvature is of the order of the radius of the disk, then it turns out that the local favored structure is sevenfold. So instead of putting six atoms around one, you have curved the system so that you can put seven atoms around one. And indeed here, you can have a heptagonal tiling. So there's no frustration here. So that's the idea that what Takashi was mentioning is that you will have a number of commensurate values for which you have no frustration. But we are interested by working at weak frustration around zero, so very far from that value. Basically, we'll go from 0.02 to 0.2 in terms of that frustration parameter, okay, spanning an order of magnitude.
Is it known what happens if you're coming down in temperature at that particular level of kappa?
Okay, we haven't done it, but it's you will have the same some crystallization. So you go down and you crystallize, and probably the same type even of weakly first order or you know, no, you know, I'm happy to work on weird systems, but I'm not sure I want to spend that much time on the possible hepatic phase of the of this model. But in principle, you could have that kind of behavior. Okay, so the absorbables, same as usual, you at the incoherent intermediate scattered function, which is defined. Everything is more complicated because it's hyperbolic space, but it's the same spirit as Euclidean space. And you see here the function as a function of log time. So that's at high temperature. This is still in the liquid, and this is when the system starts being falling out of equilibrium, and we cannot relax the system on the experimental time scale of the computer. I'll go to this, but we looked also at four-point correlation functions and stuff like this. All right, so this is, you know, in some sense, it's empirical data. That is, you try, now it's the Euclidean plane, and you try to cool your system. You look at the translational relaxation time, and in that case, we look also at the bond orientational relaxation time, but forget this, it might not be important. And no matter what we do in cooling the system, you know, you crystallize at, you know, a given temperature, or close to a given temperature. Now, then the temperature depends on system size a little bit, and the fact that it's weakly first order or continuous with a small hexatic phase in between depends also on system size. But no matter what, you never form a glass. Your system is not frustrated, and it crystallizes, period. Now, the interesting point is that, so in this T star then is crystallization, the avoided singularity. Now, when we do this by adding frustration, so T star is here, and the blue line was the translational order relaxation time. So this is the translational relaxation time on a log plot, and from the intermediate self-intermediate scattering function, and for different curvatures. Okay, so that was zero, and then it, of course, then below it's infinite. And this is decreasing curvature. So this is decreasing frustration. So what we find is that the strongest frustration that we use, that is the strongest curvature, is, you know, moderately different from an Arrhenius behavior. They are all the same at high temperature. And there's no rescaling here. Okay, that's the point of choosing exactly the same system and just changing the curvature, is that the local interactions are the same. So here we don't have to rescale, and which is always a problem. So they just fall on each other because the system locally is flat. So locally the system is flat, and at low temperature basically it's only local molecular information that you need, and everything looks the same. But as you cool, well, first you avoid the crystallization, and then your system deviates for Arrhenius more as you decrease the frustration. So the fragility of the system increases with decreasing frustration, which is what we had predicted. So that was a happy result for us. And on the theoretical side, what we like about this idea is that we can make the fragility as large as we want. Now that we know, we have an idea of how it works, how it varies actually with frustration. And that means that you can reach a regime where the collective behavior is as large as you want. Now, it is not physical. That is, again, real glass formers have fragilities that are intermediate and length scales, characteristic length scales that are not very large. But if you want to have a theory of the glass foundation that is based on collective behavior, it is nice to have a limiting range where you can make collective behavior as large as you want and then check your predictions. Because in a region where collective behavior is moderate, of course the predictions will always need subdominant terms, adjustable parameters, and it's very hard to check. Whereas here, at least in principle, you can go to a limit where we could check any kind of prediction we want. And second, of course, the onset temperature at which it starts deviating from Arrhenius behavior is around the avoided singularity. It's not at the avoided singularity, it's a crossover anyhow, but it's around that value. Okay, now if I have a little bit more time, I would like to show a few other things in terms of the structure. So that's why I showed you the Poincaré disk representation, is that those are the snapshots of the system at different temperatures. So T over T star 2.4, so this is the normal liquid in some sense. 0.98, it's very close but below this avoided singularity. And 0.5, it's still equilibrated, but it is at a lower temperature. Now, these are real snapshots. That is, it is not a polycrystalline material. That is, the whole thing here moves. The dark spots are the atoms. So this is a usual Delaunay triangulation, so that you know exactly what's the number of atoms around one. And the dark spots at six neighbors. So it's the local hexagonal or hexatic order. The green ones have seven neighbors. So it's a topological defect in that case, which is a disclination with negative charge. It's the minimum negative charge that you can have, which is seven neighbors. And the blue guys have five neighbors, and this is a positive disclination, so it's a positive topological charge for the defect. The defects, since we are in two dimensions, the defects are points. That's a big difference with three dimensions. You know, it's probably makes, in terms of the dynamics, also a big difference too, in terms of the slowing down. The defects here are point-like, whereas in three dimensions they are line-likes, okay, the disclinations. So you see here it's a whole plasma. Excuse me.
Do you know what would be the T equals zero concentration of some neighbor defect?
Yeah. well, okay. Okay. All right. So because of the curvature, let me answer this question. Because of the curvature, there are more seven. We know exactly how many there should be. There should be 12 in that case. Okay, because it's a topological requirement. Now, if you change, which means that it gives a given density. If you make a bigger simulation cell that we did, for instance, with a 14 gon, then it goes, instead of 12, it's 24. And so on. And so we know exactly what is the reducible number of seven-fold disclinations. But you see that on top of it, there are, of course, thermal defects. And those thermal defects, it looks like a plasma, almost neutral plasma of plus and minus. And as you go down, you see that the regions of hexatic order increase, So you have an increase of these regions. So here there's nothing, everything is just local. And starting below that avoided singularity, you can see these regions. And of course those regions increases. And this is close to the lowest temperature that we can achieve. And then there's an interesting structure of the defects where they form little lines with one declination and a little bit of dislocations that are pairs of blue and red. And what is specific here is that usually it's a grain boundary, if you wish. But first, the grain boundary moves all the time. And second, the grain boundary finishes in the ordered phase, whereas it's never the case, of course, in Euclidean space. I mean, your grain boundaries, you know, just circle the whole. It's a boundary. Here, it's not a real boundary.
That's because you can have extra sevenfold, right?
It's because of the curvature. So it's a specific feature of the curvature that you can. So the whole thing here moves, but anyhow, it's a picture of what we call, let's say, the frustration limited domains. Is that, you know, this local order grows, but then it in fact saturates, and that's the next thing I want to show to you is that.
It's sort of a crystalline arrangement of this 12, which minimizes energy.
Well, okay, we haven't. That would be nice, but. It's a good point. Okay. In principle, if you count here 1, 2, 3, 4, you have 12, exactly 12 arrangements of defects. Now, what could happen, that's what I was saying about the Frank-Casper phases, is that those defects could order. And you could have, you know, maybe get rid of the grain boundaries for if it's possible, but you could have at least an ordering of the 12 centers, you know, forming a super lattice. Yeah. We've looked a little bit on that, but you need periodic boundary conditions that are compatible with the super lattice. And okay, we haven't found it, but it's in principle it could be there. So again, frustration means that it will help you to avoid one crystal, but you may hit another one of the type Frank-Casper type, which is a crystal formed when the defects themselves order. Okay, and here it could be true too that at lower temperature you have a defect ordered crystal.
I mean, for a sphere, this problem is probably solved, right?
For the sphere, it's a.
Yeah, for a hypersphere where you could put defects to minimize the energy.
All right, for not for hypersphere, for a simple sphere. Because that's two-dimensional. Actually, it is not solved.
No.
I mean, it's been looked at. It's called the Thomson problem. And, you know, it has a century old or something like this. There are good solutions. That is, people know how to do small spheres. Then they are exact solutions. And on a sphere, there are exactly 12 five-fold disclinations, minimum. But again, when you increase the size of the sphere, what happens is that it seems that you have ground states like this with grain boundaries. So it's not only as if you had precisely 12 disclinations, just because there's a balance between, you know, the continuum elastic and topological requirements and the discrete nature of the atoms here. But you know, David Nelson and his co-workers and other people have worked a lot on this. So we know a lot on what's going on the sphere. And actually, we use their stuff. We worked with David Nelson to see if we could do the same on a hyperbolic plane. But it's all right. So what I just want to show here is that we can extract a correlation length. Because again, I think that at the moment, you know, one of the important issues of the theories of the glass transition is to identify what is the proper correlation length in the problem. That is, a correlation length that is indeed the source of the slowing down of the dynamics. Not just any length, you know, but the source of the slowing down. And again, since those lengths are hard to find, first in experiments we know very, very hard to find, and even in simulation it's very hard to find because it never grows very large in a normal three-dimensional case, there's a lot of discussion and trials to look at correlation length and the way they influence the dynamics. So here they will look again, as I said, as the, we know the local order, which is hexagonal or hexadic, and we can look at the correlation function, the pair correlation function of the order parameter. Now the pair correlation function is not the G of R in that case, because it involves up to four atom correlations. Okay, so it's a more complex quantity, and we extract the correlation length or modulation length from it. And what we see is that, which is expected, is that it indeed grows. Okay, so this is three different curvatures or three different frustrations, from strong to weaker frustration. It grows, but it saturates. And this one we haven't reached. I mean, it's very, very hard to measure, so we haven't reached the saturation. But it grows and it saturates. And that's, again, it's the whole idea of frustration-limited growth, is that it grows because, you know, in the vicinity of the avoided singularity, the correlation grows. But since the system is frustrated, it cannot go beyond a certain limit. And actually, this value here is exactly the radius of curvature of the system, which is also the typical distance between defects. So you saturate. So the correlation length has to saturate. Now, you can correlate it to the dynamics, you know, with an activation energy that goes like correlation length to some exponent. Now, we had two predictions for the exponent. We had that it was log of the correlation length, and working with David Nelson, that it would go linearly with the correlation length. Well, it turns out that, you know, numerically we found 0.5, but again, when, hey, too bad. On the other hand, you know, when you see the amount of data that we have, I wouldn't bother too much, because we have too little data to make any, you know, any good statement on that. So let's say this is indicative, at least, that the relaxation time seems to grow with the correlation length, but I wouldn't push this too far. Now, I'm close to the end. Dynamic heterogeneities, I would like to show a little more of these pictures. Dynamic heterogeneities, because again, this has been an interesting development in the last couple of decades on the glass transition, is looking at this idea that the dynamics was not homogeneous in a supercooled liquid, is that you had regions of fast-moving, slow-moving in the liquid, and that those regions and the associated correlations were growing as you were decreasing the temperature. And indeed, that was one way to extract the length scale, which is, you know, dynamic length scale, which is the only one that is actually accessible by experiments. So you see here an example of what is key example, what are dynamic heterogeneities, right? Is that you look at, again, it's snapshots, but here we start from a configuration and we look at it, we look at the trajectories until a time for which the average displacement is sigma, is the atom diameter. At high temperature, so above the avoided singularity, so at 1.8, you see that the damn thing is completely homogeneous. So every atom moves a little, and that's it. Now, when you lower the temperature, and this is here pretty low temperature, but again, the whole thing is moving, it's not a polycrystal, you see that most of the atoms don't move, but or move very little, they rattle, to use the jamming term. But there are regions where the motion extends on much longer distances. And in fact, in that case, it correlates very, very well with, and I don't know if you remember the other one, with the regions where we have the defects. Okay, so quite naturally, the regions where the dynamics are slow are the regions where the local order is pretty well established, even if the whole thing moves, and the region where the dynamics is easier, facilitated, faster, is the regions where you have these defects and these lines of defects.
And the correlation length is the center-to-center defect distance?
I'll show you the correlation length. Here the correlation length is basically the center-to-center distance, because this is at low temperature. But we have actually studied
but
this.
But there could be dynamic correlation lengths for the dynamic heterogeneities themselves?
I'll show you the usual definition of the dynamic heterogeneities, which might not answer completely your question. But So we've looked at the 4-point susceptibility. So for those, well, I don't know, let me maybe give the definition of it, is that we're looking at the local relaxation. So for instance, let's do it in Euclidean space, it's easier. So you're looking for atom J of exponential IK RJ of T minus RJ of zero. Everything has vectors here, okay? So this is the correlation between time T and time zero. And what we call the self-intermediate scattering function is just 1 over the number of atoms, the average, let me call this guy FJ of K and T. It's the average of this thing. Okay, so that's the average dynamics from which we extract the relaxation time of the system. Now, you might be interested by the fluctuations in the dynamics, and that's where dynamic heterogeneities, of course, come into the picture. And then the chi 4 will be 1 over n, the average of sum over j, fj of kt minus its average, squared and averaged. Okay, so that's the average and that's the fluctuation, basically. And now you can be a little more fancy and look at a correlation function, g4, which will depend on t and r. And it's basically in that case that you, since this is the square, you have a sum over I and j, and you will look at all correlations I and j such that the distance between the two points r and j is equal to r. And what we do in what I will show is that t is roughly the relaxation, we choose t as the relaxation time of the system. Anyhow, so this is the chi 4, and it has a different, it's not the simple exponential in the case of the hyperbolic plane, but just I'll save you this. So this is the susceptibility, and which, again, as a function of time, goes through a maximum. Okay, that's very well known. And basically, what is interesting is that as temperature decreases, and the maximum is roughly the relaxation time of the system, and when temperature decreases, the maximum increases, and this is evidence that some correlations grow in the dynamics of the system. That is, this basically measures, if I move here and I have dynamics here between 0 and t, how far will this affect the dynamics here between 0 and t? And
you're picking k is based on the particle size?
K is basically the maximum of the structure factor, static structure factor. So it's 2 pi over the interparticle distance. So it's a local probe here. K is a local probe. And, you know, we find that indeed that chi 4 increases as temperature decreases. And actually it reaches a regime, it increases more when the frustration is less. And it reaches a regime where it goes like 1 over t squared. So when we look at the correlation function, so that's the g4 now, for a time which is the maximum time, which is about tau, as a function of distance, well, times kappa. And, you know, we have a pretty good exponential decay for a range here from which we extract the dynamic correlation length this time. Okay? And this dynamic correlation length that we extract, it has to be shifted by temperature-independent measures because it's not the exact same way as the other one. We compare it to the structural one, that is the one for the local order parameter, the psi 6. And you see that for the three frustrations from which we have been able to do it, we find a pretty good coincidence between the evolution of those two. And this is, you know, I expected the other way around. So I was a little annoyed when I saw this result. Now,
this is without rescaling.
No, this is Well, it's temperature independent rescaling. Okay, so
you
have to shift.
Some point.
Yeah, you have, because of course the way to define the correlation length is not the same in the two case, so you allow a shift. And,
shift, not a multiplication.
All right. So but there's something actually. So it works. It seems that at least that one that works very well. There's just a small subtlety that you see that. It indeed saturates exactly at like the other one because of frustration, but when you look at the chi4, well, the chi4 keeps growing, and so that at first we were saying, hey, but this is a complete decoupling, this is weird because chi4 is just the integral of the four-point correlation function, and what turns out is that if you look at this into this more carefully. You see that there is a first exponential decrease, but there is another length scale that emerges. We have no good data on it, but it has to be. We can compare the integral of this function to the chi4, and it should be the same. And there is a small length that emerges and keeps increasing, which means anyhow that in that region. The dynamic heterogeneities and the relaxation time and the growth of the domains go together. But when you reach a low temperature regime where frustration is such that everything has saturated in terms of the structure, well, you can still have dynamic heterogeneities. Okay, so there's a decoupling indeed in that regime between the dynamic heterogeneities and the local order parameter. So schematically, we have like three regimes. We have a kind of normal liquid regime.
Would you pick that up by studying different k's?
I don't know.
It would just take off at the.
I don't think it's different k's. We could pick that up by looking at other measures of the structure.
If you do the more complicated measure,
it's not here, but we have results on the 0.2 set, and the 0.2 set preliminary result, it goes like the static one,
x86.
And actually, we have also result by the François Saucet has result, I shouldn't say we, on the length scale that was put forward by Jorge Courchan and Dov Levine, and it also goes like by the structural one, like the x86, like the hexatic one. Again, what we see is that, so there is a normal liquid regime, there is a kind of fragile supercooled regime, and then frustration comes in. I mean, everything saturates in terms of the structure, but of course still the relaxation time might be Arrhenius, for instance, in that case, and the even if there's no cooperativity in terms of the local order parameter, the dynamic heterogeneity keeps growing because again
that's a phonon contribution, right?
It's not only phonon. I mean it's not that simple. I mean we're trying to look at this for a purely Arrhenius system, but a purely Arrhenius system which is considered, for instance, a non-cooperative because it will be just a very local barrier, has dynamic heterogeneities and a diverging, if you wish, chi4 just as a fragile one.
When it has chi4, it has this diagramic.
It has, yes.
Can I just ask the.
I'm done, yes. Please ask.
This work by Olivier Deschaux?
Yes.
About looking as a function of k, right? Can't you get different behavior with different length scales? Is it somewhat arbitrary to pick the particle size?
We can't look at this on this system. I mean, it has been looked at, I think, for the three-dimensional Lennard-Jones system. Lennard-Jones system. It's not more real than this one, but when you look at the dynamics here, k it's as if you had a local probe. If k is of the order of the interatomic distance, then you're probing your dynamics on a very local base. Now, if you make k very small, of course, as you would do in for instance, in a light scattering experiment, in forced relay experiments, and K goes to zero or very, very large, then you have a probe that, of course, is no longer local. So if you have heterogeneities that are, you know, of modest size, and you probe your dynamics locally, it's fine if your K is, let's say, larger than 2 pi over the size of your heterogeneity. Once you have a K which is so small that in fact you probe a lot of heterogeneities, then you average things out and you wash this effect of dynamic heterogeneity. So there is a dependence on K,
yeah, so
but I don't know what is.
I was suggesting going even lower, as you go below, I mean, as you go higher, above 2 pi over sigma.
Oh, higher. I don't know if this has been checked. I don't.
So below the peak of K, above the peak of K.
If this part will be there, yeah.
If
you go to really very small K, you say, this thing that after the freezing, I mean, after the very low temperature, this thing is being, this will be there, or this will be there. Even if you're probing at that.
Well, point, if you're going to very, very low K, and this is what.
Not even very low K, but you know, beyond the structure where the system is frozen. If you look at over longer length scale, this the dynamic equilibrium that you see persists to very low temperature. That will disappear.
I don't know. I must say, I don't know. I mean, again, my feeling is that the dynamic heterogeneity is really something which is very robust, in a sense that any slow, it's a personal view, right? And every slow relaxing system, forming a glass or not forming a glass, will have dynamic heterogeneities. It's an intrinsic thing that basically something moving here will have some influence of something.
Even in the liquid state.
But in the liquid, no, it has to be slowly moving. That is, not because if it's at high temperature and it's fast moving, then everything is homogeneous. So that it is still non-trivial. The fact that as you lower the temperature, you will get those dynamic heterogeneities is something which is non-trivial. But I think it's a very generic phenomenon, and that you could be found in many different systems, even not specifically glass formers.
Yes, yeah, if the system is not behaving like it, see, even in the liquid state you are seeing this peak, it's only just growing. If it is looked at that length scale where it is frozen, the liquid-like behavior is gone, would you see the peak?
I don't know. By changing the value of K such that, I don't know. I haven't thought about it, and we haven't done it. Okay, so I guess it's pretty much, I don't know what I have on this, but yeah, so that's things that I said already, you know, I don't want to stress it. So I have, not claiming that this is the ultimate theory of the glass transition, you know, I think they are pretty good competitors, but I think at least we see the physical mechanism for you know, the slowing down and the fact that you deviate from Arrhenius behavior, and that could be related to frustration. And also we have a strategy for, again, a theoretical strategy, okay? And I don't know how it would be much better to do this in, of course, experiments, but how to exaggerate the collective properties so that we can make statements that we could prove, which is one thing which is missing in this field is make hard statements that can be proven or disproven. This is so difficult otherwise. All right, that's it. Thank you. Yes.
So,
I'm not leaving.
So I guess the engineering question that's connected to the glass transition question is what makes something a good glass former, right? And so the picture here seems pretty clear. It's that things that are more frustrated are going to be more Arrhenius and probably are going to be better glass formers. But it seems to leave open the question of how, in general, do we quantify frustration? Like if you were given some generic system, not one you had the chance to engineer from the beginning, how would you put a number on that? And I was wondering if you gave any thought to that question.
Well, we have, but with no answer, unfortunately. I mean, the again, we have to make sure that we can define frustration. Is it will be like how a local order can extend or not extend. Mm-hmm. Now, if we know what is the local order, then we are in better business to see how to quantify how it can extend. The main problem we have so far with this approach, which makes it useless so far for engineering or this kind of this kind of approach, is that we have no idea of how to define the local order. And then except by fitting after the facts and extracting a frustration number, but this is very annoying because you have to first know the fact to get the number. We don't know how to indeed quantify and tell anything about this problem. So this is a big shortcoming of that might never be resolved. That is, maybe this approach will never be able to tell anything, like which will of course limit its use.
Yeah, if I could jump in, we published some work about 6 years ago that doesn't answer this question, but maybe
we're many of us.
Maybe take the first step. What we did was we asked the question, how can we calculate the packing efficiency around a given atom site in a binary metallic glass or more complex glass crusher? And so what we did is we looked at a particular atom site. And that atom site, that atom has a radius, and that radius defines the degree of curvature. And then you need to pack atoms on that curved surface. And furthermore, in some cases, we know what the partial coordination number is. We know how many types of atoms and what their radii are in the first shell. And so we've come up with an approach that estimates the amount of space available on that curved surface that's actually occupied by the number and type of atoms present. And what we found, we published this in 2004, what we found for just about every metallic glass we looked at is that the space was very efficiently filled around both the solutes and the solvents, with some exceptions. We looked at, for example, there was an aluminum-based glass, a ternary glass, where we found that packing was very efficient around the solutes, but not around the solvents. And we just recently extended that to calcium ternary glass, and we find that their packing is efficient around all three atom sites. So there is this approach that we've developed that basically is taking a simplified approach to the Thomas problem, looking at how much space on a curved surface is actually occupied given the number and type of atoms present. So there is some approach, but again, it's a rather selective view of local packing frustration. And it doesn't extend it beyond that, but there are some approaches. Yeah.
Let me put words in that both guys' mouth.
Better to put words in our mouth than feet in our mouths.
Please do.
So if you translate this into three dimensions, what you're saying is this is the Euclidean 3D, right? And that one is this space with actually positive curvature, which is well known for a long time. Nelson and everybody, Sadat and everybody looked at the system with whether you can extend icosahedra and close the space. So it is a closed space. So, it'll be interesting to see if this closed space is something physical, so you can actually do the MD. And see if there's an icosahedric transition, like hexatic transition in that space. And anyway, so that you're saying
if I may interrupt, it has been done.
Oh, it has been done.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there is a transition like this, which is indeed much. It's weakly first order, and it's easier. It happens at a higher temperature than in the crystalline transition in three dimensions, but there is simulation. There is simulation result on this by Strally in the 80s, late 80s.
You can't like the first orders of a finite system and
Right, okay.
Right, that is the problem.
Okay, but it doesn't look like, it looks more like rounded first order than rounded second order, if you will.
So that, if that's the case, the, fail influence comes from that condition, while in 3D, the crystallization we know is out here. Glass condition is about 40% of the crystallization temperature. So that's my problem.
No, well, let's. No, the I mean, in Zohar, I think estimated some of this on the basis of what we had done is that even in the case of Strali, I think the melting, I've put this like this, but T star is roughly around the melting temperature. It's probably slightly I think it's slightly above. So that's the melting to another crystal, it could be HCP or FCC.
So experimentally, TG is about.
And but TG is not here. Okay. T star is the beginning, it's the onset, okay? So the TG will be here.
Oh, I see.
Okay, so the T star is what I showed in the. It's a crossover where it starts beginning collected. And indeed, it's what we found empirically by fitting. Is that it is always very close to the melting temperature, maybe slightly above in general, which you would expect because it's easier to crystallize when there's no frustration. But no, the TG is much better. So it, for that matter, it satisfies the constraints from experiments. Yeah. But it's
now, next is that the dance ratio in 3D is like the exercise is strongly plasmated.
Yes.
10% in radius of the central atom. So if the change in size is just like a local change in local curvature, and if it reduces frustration, I'm not sure, but then if it does, then you're going that direction, right? So you're becoming more fragile rather than strong. So it should become more difficult to make glasses, unless
Increasing
frustration somewhere. But anyway, if that is the direction that the alloying or mixing atoms is going to maximize the packing level, right? So if that is the reducing the frustration, then it looks like it's going the other way.
Well, and it's increasing the fragility. and the glasses that I described are typically pretty fragile glasses.
Then it's a less stable glasses.
It's not easy. Well, when you say stable, I mean there are different ways of describing. They're more fragile glasses.
Right, they're more difficult to form glasses. Okay, stronger glasses are easier to form glasses. So, then you need to get an ideal glass that you should do the other one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good point. Okay, can I? These results that. So all these coalition lengths seem to be pretty much the same in your system, where this hexadecoil coalition length is determined from anything else.
There are some at least for one regime, okay, right. Before saturation.
So there are some work by Tanaka and others who are looking at just two-dimensional fluxes,
yes.
But binary emissions.
Yes.
Or
polydispersed.
Polydispersed, yes. They find that this heterogeneity length scale and this hexadic length scale and the time scale.
Everything goes the same.
Everything goes the same. So in your case, this length basically will saturate at some value as you go to more.
Yes.
Whereas they sort of claim that.
They didn't think about it, but I think it would be the same in their case. because in their case, in the polydispersed case, at least. So in the polydispersed case, you have what happens is that above, I don't remember, 8% of polydispersity. Mm-hmm. So in that case, you have the same diagram. You have T, and you have polydispersity.
Yeah.
Now, the difference in that case is that you need a threshold okay, of about 8% or maybe 7, I don't know exactly, above which you form no crystal. So this is the hexagonal crystal, and this is again zero polydispersity, so that the T star and the whole line here actually is critical, and they look at stuff going here, but I think that.
So you'd expect that
it will saturate the same way when you go to low enough temperature. Because
or if they go to higher polydispersity?
Or you go to high, but it goes in the same direction in what he says. When you go to higher polydispersity, the fragility decreases.
So you should saturate, you should see the length.
Yes, that's right, saturating. Exactly, saturating before. So if you look precisely at the hexatic length, it should be, of course, bigger when you're here, decrease that way and should saturate at some point.
Yeah, so that they haven't gone to low enough temperatures or whatever.
Yeah.
They try to, that's what I find very strange, that they try to claim that it is just mising exponent, etc.
Yeah, I find everything very strange in that in those papers. So I, you know, and everything fits exactly, you know, on the nose without any, you know, adjustment and all that. But yeah, it seems to. It is compatible with all we've done here, the results.
So this increasing length scale of the dynamical heterogeneities, you're saying that's so bad, the dynamical heterogeneity length scale keeps increasing, but this one is saturated.
Yes.
That's not a cooperative sense. Things have grown up to some cooperative length scale, and then the dynamics is slowing down just because those things have to move around.
It is my picture, but it might be that you move, you know, from one cooperativity to another, you know. But the easiest picture, at least the Occam's razor picture, is that indeed you have cooperativity that grows and dynamic heterogeneity grows with it, and then cooperativity saturates, and then you still have dynamic heterogeneity as you would have for any stupid Arrhenius behavior.
But then the length scale should
sorry
show
for the stupid.
A difference.
I didn't. People are leaving the room. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to offend anyone.
But then the length, the way the chi 4.
It changes, it crosses over. Yes.
Cross
over. Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
I looked at the connectivity like the hydrogen singles, monodispersive system, it goes just like that and saturates. So must be this chi 4 behavior.
Or the wrong term for order.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.